Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Very pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got senior voices and more from our occasional series Culture Couch. You'll need to buckle up for that one. And later in the program, a conversation with a local farmer about rural life and some of the challenges and benefits that go with that life. We'll also talk about what has made this year's corn crop so darn tall. Up first, a series of stories on some challenges facing the education system. A new WISO analysis of state education data shows Ohio school officials issued 30,000 suspensions to K through third grade students in the 2016 school year. In Dayton, hundreds of younger students are removed from classrooms each year. It's a problem education policy experts have been trying to tackle for years. Many studies show children who miss too much school struggle to keep up when they return. As WISO's April Leslie reports, this is especially true for elementary age students.
It's early on a Saturday morning, and I'm in a car with Zakia Zankara Jabbar, taking a trip down memory lane. We're on our way to an elementary school on Dayton's west side, where her son Amir was a student for several years. Zankara Jabbar used to make this drive to drop him off every morning, and to pick him up during the numerous times Amir was pulled out of class for behavior his teachers didn't like. As Zankara Jabbar explained, the problem started when he began preschool.
And I remember as soon as he enrolled, within a week, I was getting phone calls from the preschool teachers.
The teachers told her Amir was being disruptive, that he was throwing temper tantrums and needed to be picked up from school. Zankara Jabbar, a college student at the time, was confused. Amir loved learning and hadn't had many behavior issues before. So she tried starting a discussion about it with his teachers.
I said, is anything he's doing abnormal for a three-year-old child? And I remember they would use coded language like, you may want to get him evaluated. You may want to do this. And I was like, wait, evaluated? Evaluated for what?
The calls kept coming. Amir was being pulled out of class multiple times per week. And all those trips to the school began taking a toll.
I had to drop out of college because they asked me to pick him up so much. They would call me while I'm sitting in class to come and pick him up. This happens all the time.
Zankara Jabbar's son, Amir, is one of thousands of Ohio students suspended before reaching the fourth grade. During the 2016-2017 academic year, Dayton school officials issued suspensions to 650 kindergarten through third grade students. That number has been increasing slightly since 2014. It's a problem that isn't unique to the Miami Valley. Dr. Valerie Loy is a researcher who heads up the state's Early Childhood Mental Health Initiative.
Nationally, young children are expelled in some communities at a greater rate than high school students.
Reasons for these disciplinary measures range from what's called violent or aggressive behavior, like biting or fighting with another child, to disruptive behavior, like not following directions or talking out of turn. So why is it happening?
Expulsion is not a child behavior problem. It's an adult decision problem.
Aloy says there are often many factors that play into school officials' decisions to remove a child from the classroom after encountering a challenging behavior.
Their own stress level, their perception of the child, the resources that the teacher may or may not have to support the number of children in the classroom.
Many preschool classrooms are short-staffed. Elementary schools are often under-resourced. And many teachers are forced to buy classroom supplies out of their own pockets, despite low salaries. Poverty is also a factor for the children. A Yale University study found that children from low-income families are more likely to be suspended or expelled from preschools. Race also plays a major role. A WISO analysis of state education data reveals school officials remove children of color from the classroom much more often than white children. Although black students make up only 16% of Ohio's total student population, they made up 51% of students suspended during the 2016-2017 school year. Black male students are suspended more than any other demographic, with more than 65,000 total suspensions reported during that same year. Aloy says research shows that any underlying behavioral issues are not resolved by removing children from classrooms. Instead, she says, the problems often become worse.
When little ones are out of school, they're not well supervised, they can become victimized, and eventually they come in contact with criminal justice.
Zakia Zankara Jabbar didn't want that to happen to her son. She pulled Amir out of the preschool that kept suspending him and eventually enrolled him in an all-boys school in Dayton. And then she braced herself for the calls.
And I remember a week went by, 2 weeks went by, And then the third week, I'm like, I'm worried.
So she went to Amir's school, hoping to observe her son and talk to his teacher, Mr. Burris.
When I walked in, they were in there. The kids were up, jumping and clapping, and they're doing the hip-hop ABC recital. And I was just like, oh, this is different.
Afterwards, Ankara Jabbar pulled Mr. Burris aside to talk.
I said, how are things going? How is Amir? And he said, oh, he's one of my best students. I was like, what? And he looked at me, and I remember tears started to fall. And I said, really? I said, I've never heard anybody say that about him.
That experience confirmed what Zankara Jabbar already suspected, that Amir just needed a teacher able to take a different approach. After hearing similar stories from other parents, Zankara Jabbar began pushing lawmakers to change the state's school disciplinary policies. She and her advocacy group, Racial Justice Now, attracted the attention of Republican State Senator Peggy Lehner. Last year, Lehner introduced the SAFE Act. The bill would bar schools from suspending or expelling younger students for so-called minor offenses. It's now been approved by both chambers of the Ohio legislature. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
DPS officials were unable to provide a comment in time for our deadline on this story. Now our look at the state's high rates of suspensions for young students continues with a more detailed discussion about how some lawmakers have proposed banning such minor offense school suspensions. WYSO's Jess Mador spoke with April Leslie to learn more about the legislation.
The state has made it clear that they're not really trying to curb giving suspensions for more severe actions, maybe more violent actions, like taking a gun to school, for example, or a bomb threat. They're trying to cut down on pretty much everything else, though, at least for those younger students. Now, this wouldn't happen all at once. It would be phased in over 4 school years. They're doing that because, as Senator Lehner told me, they understand that it's a big change, that it's going to take a while for teachers and school districts to not use out-of-school suspension as a tool in that disciplinary toolbox. Now, what Senator Lehner did tell me is they're trying to give teachers and other school administrators different tools that they can use if they encounter a challenging behavior in the classroom. A big focus in the bill is really on providing more professional development opportunities for teachers and school administrators. Also, it would require school districts to adopt a framework for PBIS, that means Positive Behavior Intervention and Supports. Essentially, what all this means is the state is trying to get schools and teachers to think outside of the box when it comes to school discipline.
You know, these are younger students, many of them under the age of 9, right? And so they're learning how to act in the classroom. They're learning how to be in school. But some might ask, why would teachers not be able to discipline kids when they are being disruptive and making it potentially harder for other kids in the classroom to learn?
I think that the idea is not so much that we stop disciplining these children, but that we take suspension out of the question, because we know that taking children out of school has potentially detrimental effects over the long term. Nobody is saying we shouldn't try to correct these behaviors. We shouldn't try to, you know, explain to a child what's appropriate behavior in a classroom. I think that the idea is more, let's come up with a solution that doesn't harm the child overall.
So what does the research show about suspension in younger children? What have you heard?
Well, one of the things that was mentioned to me by many sources is the school-to-prison pipeline. So what this means in practice is, let's say you're suspending a 7-year-old. The 7-year-old doesn't have a parent that can watch them during daytime hours, and that child is left to fend for themselves, and they end up getting involved in some criminal activity, and it leads them at younger ages to prison. And that's something that I think everybody wants to avoid here. The data also shows a clear link between being suspended at a young age and dropping out of high school later on. So we know that it leads to just worse educational outcomes overall.
April, what has the reaction been to the legislation so far?
Senator Lehner told me that the reaction has been pretty positive. She did say initially some teachers were upset because it sounds like, you know, you're just putting an outright ban on something that they've been using as a tool for many years without really offering an alternative. But she did say that a lot of those concerns were alleviated when they heard about the support for professional development that's also in the bill. I also spoke to Zakiya Zankara Jabbar, who was one of the main sources in the earlier story. Zakiya is part of an advocacy group called Racial Justice Now, and she says that they're pretty thrilled that the bill has made it this far, but that they are disappointed that the issue of racial disparity wasn't really addressed in the bill.
if you look at the research, and we know, right, that black children don't behave any worse than any other group of children, is just that they're targeted more. And so that's something that we're critical of.
We know from the data that black children are suspended at much higher rates than white children. Specifically, black boys are suspended more than any other group.
You know, this sounds like a big problem with many nuanced parts, right? So what are some of the other solutions that some communities you found in your reporting tried that have worked in the past when it comes to disciplining young children in school?
So one solution that has been suggested is offering implicit bias training to teachers and school administrators. You may have heard of that from the Starbucks incident. So it aims to decrease instances of racial discrimination by making people more aware of kind of subconscious racial bias that they may have that might be affecting the way that they make decisions. Also, the state started something new in 2017. They started offering this early childhood educational kind of hotline. It was established essentially to prevent expulsions of really young kids, kids in preschool specifically. A teacher or another child care worker can call this hotline if they're having trouble with a child maybe and they're thinking about expelling that child. They can call this hotline and the state will dispatch the right support services for them. So that's another solution that's being tried out right now.
What happens next with this legislation? What can we expect?
Well, the bill has made it through both the House and the Senate at this point, and we're just awaiting the governor's signature. If it is signed, it's going to take about 4 years for it to be fully implemented.
Thank you, April.
Thank you.
Our look at education continues on WISO Weekend. More than 140,000 Ohio students are preparing to enter their senior year of high school. But for thousands of them, the year won't end with a walk across a stage in a cap and gown. That is unless lawmakers move the graduation goalpost once again. State Impact Ohio's Ashton Mara reports it's a lingering question that's creating uncertainty for rising seniors in the state's high schools.
16-year-old Jemiah Goley is about a month away from starting her senior year at Kenmore Garfield High School in Akron. She's a cheerleader and says her favorite subject is science, forensics, and biology. She's anxious about the upcoming school year.
They say your senior year goes by faster than your junior year, and my junior year flew by, so I'm just nervous.
That nervousness, though, it's not about actually graduating. Jemiah has gotten 20 points on Ohio's 7 end-of-course exams, and you only need 18 to meet the state testing requirement for a diploma. But in her class of 170 at Kenmore Garfield, 120 students haven't met that requirement yet. Principal Frank Kalane says
they're going to keep taking the tests until
he never finishes the thought. But he explains all 120 students will receive special interventions this school year to help prepare them to retake the exams in October and April. Those interventions are online learning modules that most students will take during a study hall period. The class of 2019 is the first to face these new, more rigorous tests that most need to graduate. Students can also complete a certificate in a career tech field, a requirement that often takes several semesters to meet, or achieve a remediation-free score on the ACT or SAT, which Kalane says doesn't help many.
If a kid can't pass these tests, how are they going to pass the ACT and be college ready?
The class of 2018, which should have been the first required to meet the new standards, they were given some alternative options after the State Department of Education discovered a third of them couldn't meet the more rigorous requirements. The Ohio Board of Education has requested the alternative pathways be extended to the classes of 2019 and 2020. But the chair of the Senate Education Committee says it's unlikely to happen. And Tom Gunlock says that's a good thing.
I just think we're shortchanging our students by not demanding more from them.
Gunlock was president of the State Board of Education when the new graduation standards were approved in 2014. He says the previous Ohio graduation test was too easy, requiring students to master 8th grade level content, while the new tests are at a 10th grade level. Now students have to prove they've learned in high school, he says, and the state shouldn't bend, even if that means taking a hit to the overall graduation rate.
Everybody keeps coming back and saying, well, 100% of our kids aren't going to graduate. Well, that was never the case in the first place. So I'm all for 100% of our kids graduating with an education. not 100% of our kids graduating just for a participation trophy.
Across the country, states are struggling to find the requirements that prove students have in fact received the level of education that Gunlock is pushing for. Jennifer Zinth with the nonpartisan policy group, the Education Commission of States, says no one has found the silver bullet, but many are ending testing requirements.
States have been moving away from so-called exit exams over the last several years, exit exams being a state-set exam that students are required to pass in order to graduate from high school.
But for incoming seniors in Ohio, those testing requirements likely won't change. Only the General Assembly has the ability to adjust them, and the State House has already been shuttered for the legislature's summer break. At Kenmore Garfield, Principal Killane says 30 seniors are just 1 or 2 points away from meeting the testing requirement, and it's expected they can do it during retesting this year. For the other 90 of her classmates, Jemiah says the heavy dependence on exams isn't fair.
We spend all this time in school, you know, getting good grades, coming to school on time, doing what we're supposed to do, but when it comes to tests, like, a lot of us, we're not good at tests. Like, it's a lot of pressure put on us.
Of all the senior activities, Jemiah says she's most excited for her actual graduation ceremony. But there's a chance as many as half of her classmates won't make it there. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Ashton Mara.
I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. This week on Senior Voices, Mary Jane Martin talks about her early life in rural Alabama and has some good advice to pass on to her grandkids. She shared her story with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Cynthia Wallace King.
I was born November the 22nd, 1942, in a small town called Wedowee, Alabama. My parents was Rosa Satterwhite and S.B. Satterwhite. And we lived on a 168-acre land that we cultivated and worked. We planted cotton, corn, peppers, peas, peanuts, sugarcane, anything that could be planted, we planted it. Trust me. We had cows, which I couldn't milk. My two brothers did. We had horses and mules, which we used the mules to plow the fields. So I am a farm girl. I came to Dayton in 1972. And as I was up here, I met a young man, which I'm still with. And so we got married. And he didn't know that my kids was mine when we was courting. He thought they was my sisters and brothers. And I told him, I thought they were just sisters and brothers. He said, well, it's too late now to be wearing my kids. We have been dating, I believe, almost 3 years, I think. And he said, it's too late to be wearing my kids. I said, well, I'm just letting you know, because obviously you didn't know. He thought they was my mom and dad kids. So I guess I've had a pretty funny life, I guess. There's one thing that will keep you from learning. You'll miss a lot of things if you don't learn to listen. You have to listen, because if you're running your mouth and not listening when people are talking to you, there's going to be a lot of stuff you're going to miss that you should have heard. So I just would like for them to learn to listen and only speak speak if necessary. Be good listeners. So that is definitely, just work hard and remember that God loves them, and I love them. I want them to have the best, to be the best that they can be.
That was 75-year-old Mary Jane Martin speaking with Cynthia Wallace King as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Zeb Reichert. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible by the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. Well, 50 years ago, a movie director named Peter Yates and a young rising star named Steve McQueen made a car into a movie star. The movie was called Bullet. McQueen played a cop who drove a Highland Green 68 Mustang Fastback. Car guy and Culture Couch producer Jim Kale has the story.
Not too many people remember that the movie won an Academy Award for film editing, but every car guy and every car girl knows the classic chase scene. Steve McQueen in his Highland Green 68 Fastback Mustang chasing the bad guys in a dark 68 Charger. 7 minutes of real cars on real streets. No CGI, no fake explosions, no special effects, just the real deal. I love the sound of that Mustang. So does Mustang owner and Ford salesman Aaron Robinson of Miamisburg, Ohio. He describes the perfect job.
Race on Sunday, sell on Monday.
Aaron's a car guy and sells cars for a living. He drives with the radio and the cell phone turned off.
I'm driving. I pay more attention to the car than I do anything. I love the way it sounds.
He thinks the world will be poorer when electric cars take over, humming and not roaring. For now, Ford is still making Mustangs that roar, including a new 50th anniversary Bullet edition. The 1968 movie helped spark an excitement about the Mustang that burns to this day. With over 100 clubs devoted to the Mustang in the U.S. alone, it was no surprise to find one of the clubs meeting the first Wednesday of each month at Lakota High School, north of Cincinnati. Attend one of their meetings and you'll find members talking horsepower and trading spare parts. They go to car shows together and hold a big annual car show in June, then donate the proceeds to local veterans, a hospice, and a local food pantry. Anita Fithen is the club president and currently has a 2004 premium convertible, not her first Mustang. I asked Anita if she'd seen the Bullet movie.
When it first came out, yeah, 50 years ago, definitely made an impression on me. Yes, it did. My very first car after that, I bought a Mustang.
Kurt Zeiser from Carlisle, Ohio, has a 1965 Mustang.
I remember seeing bits and pieces of Bullet growing up, 10, 11 years old, when I first realized what Bullet Mustang was. My uncle is a big Mustang guy, and he was talking about it. The car's pretty sweet. I love it.
With the 50th anniversary of the movie, there's been more talk than usual about what happened to the original Bullet Mustang. The last trace was in 1974 when an ad appeared in Road and Track magazine. Bullet Mustang, driven by Steve McQueen in the movie, can be documented. Best offer. Bob Kiernan of Madison, New Jersey, ponied up $6,000 for the iconic Mustang, nearly twice what a new 74 would have cost. He drove it on the streets. Eventually, it became his wife's daily driver to and from a Catholic school where she taught third grade. The car became a part of the family, and in December of 1977, when Steve McQueen wrote and asked to buy the car back, Bob dismissed it out of hand. The car remained in hiding until the Kiernan family brought it to the attention of the Historic Vehicle Association. They documented the car and made it the 21st entry on the National Vehicle Register, which led to the current international tour of the Bullet Mustang. Tony Fithen of the Cincinnati Mustang Club summed it up when asked about his recollection of the car.
Well, the first time I saw it, I guess, was when the movie came out, but we didn't realize at that time that it was going to be such an icon. It's always been around. It seems it keeps coming back.
Thank you, Mr. McQueen. Thank you, Mr. Yates, for making a movie that has helped keep the Mustang around for all these years.
That was Community Voices producer Jim Kale for Culture Couch, our series on the arts and culture in the Miami Valley. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenny, and this is WISO Weekend on WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. Well, one voice that we looked for this week was that of a local farmer for a report we did on local corn crops. We found that voice from a Jamestown farmer named Jim Spar. He owns and operates an 800-plus acre farm and has been doing that work for about 45 years. We talked to him not only about this year's corn crop, but farm life in general and issues like the use of chemicals in farming and the challenges that come from rural living. We spoke to him at his farm located in Jamestown on the road that bears his name.
There's lots of roads around this township and around Ohio, for that matter, that have family names on them. And the reason they had those names on them, they were named after the people that happened to live there. They identified the road by who lived on that road. Well, Spars lived on that road, and this road over here, Brickles lived on it, and the next road over, Lackeys. And some of those families are still around, and some aren't. But this road was really nothing more than a cow path for many years, and that's how they identified who lived on it, by the name of the road. So the road was here before me.
So we're going to talk about the corn crop specifically for this season, but I want to know, what are your biggest challenges as a large rural farmer?
Well, by today's standards, I don't know that I'm a particularly large farmer, but one of the challenges is to trying to be profitable and do as good a job as you can, you know, growing a crop and make ends meet. That's always been that way and probably always will be for farmers.
With regard to the current corn crop, so the old saying goes knee high by the 4th of July, and the corn is super tall this year. They've got the tassels on. Your perspective on that?
I would say the corn is ahead of schedule. Right through here, it went in very well. And it has never stopped the whole time. We've been almost probably perfect right through here on rain. I don't know how the rest of the country is, or the rest of Ohio for that matter, but right through Greene County, I think we have very good crops. And I know it seems tall for this stage, starting to tassel already at really a little shorter height. And typically when you plant the corn early, it doesn't get as tall as it does when you plant it later. People don't seem to know that, but that's a fact about corn. Later planted, it gets taller. It doesn't yield any better. It doesn't yield as well, but it usually gets taller when you plant it later.
Does it cause any issues for the crop to tassel earlier? I mean, how does that affect your harvesting schedule? Or that doesn't matter. You harvest when it's ready.
I would think harvest might be a little bit earlier this year because the crop went in good time and it has come along real fast. And I would think harvest might be a little earlier. I would think the yields might be a bit better, but we've got a long ways to go. We've got several months. We need rain in July and August, so we'll just have to see how the weather plays out.
Anything else that needs pointing out about this year's crop?
Well, the markets aren't too good, but they haven't been too good for the last couple of years. That's just kind of business as usual. They're really on farm. It seems like a lot of times we have low prices. Therefore, we've had the government subsidies to prop up agriculture. It's just the way it is on the farm. But hopefully we'll have a good yield this time, and that'll cover some for a low price.
Let me ask you something that I don't know that a lot of people understand. So a lot of corn is grown for produce, and I know a lot of corn actually isn't meant to be eaten.
Well, a lot of this corn goes for animal feed, but a lot of the corn around here will go for high fructose corn syrup and also for ethanol. But when they produce ethanol, and they don't get this information out too much, all they use out of the corn is the sugar to make the alcohol, ethanol. And when they get done, they've got the miller's grain left, and they've got oil and other byproducts that are used for animal feed. So ethanol is a better thing than people think. It doesn't use the whole crop, the whole product. It just uses the sugar. That's what it takes to make alcohol.
And the corn you're raising here, are you doing one or the other or both?
Well, it's hard to say where this corn will go. I've got corn contracted to a few different places, and some of that will probably go for ethanol, and some of it will probably go for high fructose corn syrup. But I know the corn that I'm moving right now is actually going to the dairies around here, which will be for milk production.
So farming, anything else you want to tell us about life out here?
Life on the farm's good. It's a good place to be. It's a good place to raise your family. And we've been out here a lot of years. And my wife, she also grew up on a farm, so we both like what we do and glad to be here, very thankful.
Anything you can tell us about the future outlook for farmers in this area?
Well, the farms seem to continue to be getting bigger. There's a lot of young guys who would like to get into farming. Pretty tough to get into it. So, and I'm assuming the farms will continue to get bigger maybe. I don't know how far that'll go. They're bigger now than I ever thought they would get. So, you know, 9,000 and 10,000 acre farms aren't uncommon. So I don't know where it's going.
I don't know if it's affecting. I grew up in Bellbrook, and a lot of that is development is taking over. I don't know if that's affecting farms out there, but what's taking place here in the Jamestown area?
I don't think we're seeing as much development as we did years ago, and I don't think we'll see that much in the future. There used to be a lot of smaller farms around that someone would own that they would decide, well, we're going to sell off a few building lots so we'll have some money to buy that house in Florida for our retirement or whatever they might be wanting to do. And there's not so much that anymore. There's a lot of big farms around, and a lot of these big farms, I think, are going to stay in one piece. Plus, we've got things like the Tecumseh Land Trust that's involved in it, too, and they're out of Yellow Springs, actually, and they're protecting a lot of farmland in Clark and Greene counties. But you get closer to some of the cities, they're still having a fair amount of development there. But I think we need to protect our farmland. After all, we do have to eat.
Tecumseh's doing actually a lot of work. We've talked to them several times on local issues. Are they involved directly with your farm at all?
Yeah, we've been involved with Tecumseh Land Trust to some degree, and great people, and I think they're doing big things. And there's a lot of land in this area that has conservation easements, which is a good thing for the community. I really believe that. Like I said, we can't build houses on every acre. We've got to have places to farm. And also, I'm not sure it mixes up real well. A lot of people move out from the city, and they have some problems with animals and machinery moving up and down the roads and chemicals. And chemicals are a fact of life on these farms. We can't farm without them and produce enough food to feed the world. And it's a fact of life out on the farm.
Well, Jim, I appreciate the time, and you've got a beautiful place here. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for stopping out. It's a pleasure to meet you and talk with you.
Jamestown farmer Jim Sparr talking about rural life and some of the challenges and benefits that go with that life. And we sure appreciate the information about this season's corn crop. We also talked to the USDA this week, and they told us that other crops, including soybean, oats, and winter wheat, are also doing very well this growing season. You might want to take a drive into the countryside near you and witness the splendor of it all. I'm Jerry Kenney. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Coming up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.